From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Lisa Mullins, and for Jeremy Hobson, it's Here and Now. A strengthening Hurricane Harvey is nearing the Gulf Coast of Texas, and federal officials say they're preparing to respond to the first major natural disaster to occur in Donald Trump's presidency.
There is an acting Homeland Security Secretary in place. The man who held the job, General John Kelly, is now Trump's chief of staff, brought in to manage a different kind of storm, the tempest inside the White House, including this morning on Twitter and all week, the president lashing out today at fellow Republicans by name, today Tennessee Senator Bob Corker. We're going to keep an eye on Harvey, but we start with our political roundtable. So let's bring in Jesse Holland, who covers race, ethnicity, and politics for the AP. Hi, Jesse.
How you doing?
And Beth Fooey, senior politics editor at NBC News and MSNBC. Hi, Beth.
Hi.
And Jesse, start with Corker in the tweets this morning. Corker, had questioned President Trump's stability and competence after Trump initially didn't call out white supremacists in Charlottesville, and also said there were fine people there with them. Today, Trump tweeted, "Strange statement by Bob Corker, considering that he's constantly asking me whether or not he should run again in 18. Tennessee, not happy." What's going on there?
Well, it seems like President Trump loves attacking senators in their states when their states are in the news. The RNC is meeting in Nashville right now. So the world is, especially the Republican world, is focused on Tennessee right now. So now is the time, it seems, the president takes to go after Bob Corker. It sort of puts Republican senators in a bad position. This is their guy. This is the guy that they went out and campaigned for. Corker, even though he's criticized the president since he's in office, helped President Trump win his election. And now he's facing the attack from the president. It doesn't seem like they can really win with this guy.
Well, and just to quickly, is someone like a Bob Corker in trouble in Tennessee because he's criticized Trump?
My guess is that what President Trump is assuming, that you don't need a Corker to win that seat. A Republican will win in Tennessee. So he feels like he can criticize him and maybe even primary a Bob Corker, and a Republican will keep that seat. The same with the other senators he's criticized, John McCain in Arizona, Jeff Flake in Arizona. He's assuming that a Republican can win those seats, so he feels freer to criticize them. That's what I think is possibly going on here.
Okay. And Beth, any thoughts on your end?
Well, it's been a long week of Trump criticizing members of his own party. He went after Senators McCain and Flake when he was down in Arizona. He's had that feud with Mitch McConnell that's become very public this week. Today, it's Corker. He's not very strategic, it may seem to many, that he would be doing this, that he'd be going after members of his own party in this way. And I think in the case of Corker, it's just personal spite and vindictiveness because he's angry about Corker suggesting that he's not stable. And that was a pretty strong suggestion.
Right, yeah.
I would argue, though, that by going after members of his own party, as he has done this week, what he's doing is he is setting up the Republicans on the Hill to take the fall if his legislative battles fall apart, if he can't get through anything meaningful between now and the end of this half of year. He's going to be able to say to his base, look, it wasn't me, it was the Republicans in Congress who messed everything up. Mm-hmm. And he's not wrong in that Republicans in Congress are much, much less popular than he is with Republican voters. So he's giving himself political cover to go after these folks and to train their sights on them. On the other hand, if he actually wants to accomplish anything, if he wants to get some things done that he can point to as accomplishments, he needs those folks in his camp. So it's a little odd that he is sort of siding with base politics over accomplishment, which ultimately would help the base more than just stoking fights.
I want to turn now to what's happening, obviously, in Texas with Hurricane Harvey bearing down on the state right now and possibly expanding to other places as well. Donald Trump's FEMA director, Brock Long, was asked how confident he is that the systems are in place to respond to what seems to be the first big storm in many years off the Gulf Coast, at least since Katrina.
Let me set expectations. Texas is about to get hit by a major hurricane, so there's going to be damage. Not only are you going to see large-scale storm surge damage, but we're also going to see over the next 3 to 5 days significant amount of rainfall, which is going to cause a great amount of inland flooding. So there's going to be damage. Now, FEMA is already positioned inside both states of Texas as well as Louisiana.
That tape comes to us from ABC. Long is widely praised in emergency response circles. Donald Trump is proposing, though, an 11% cut to FEMA's budget. What are you both going to be watching for from President Trump and his team as well as it handles this storm? Jesse?
Keep in mind that natural disasters are fraught with danger for political candidates. Keep in mind what happened with President Bush and Michael Brown during Katrina, and what happened with Chris Christie in New Jersey when he actually came out and stood with President Obama after Superstorm Sandy. So
let's remind people with President Bush, because it's getting to be history now. With President Bush, it was the good job brownie, but it wasn't.
Right.
The split screen on the TV showed it was a miserable response to Katrina. And then with Chris Christie, he was just a joyous, you know, bro. You know, he was President Obama's best friend, and that got him in a lot of trouble with Republicans.
Right. So that's what we'll be looking for. I mean, because sometimes, especially with local officials, you can't win. You're either with the federal government, which, of course, during good times, people don't want the federal government in their states, or you're turning away the federal government, which in the middle of a nasty disaster, everyone needs help. So we'll be keeping a close eye on how this affects the politics in Texas when this comes around.
And Beth, one last thing, I mean, just something that we're thinking about looking ahead is that Long, the FEMA director, is looking to limit flood insurance for homes that consistently flood. This is something that the Obama administration was looking for. This is something environmentalists are calling for as well. These homes that are built over and over and over again with taxpayer FEMA dollars, they want these people out of the flood-prone areas. But Trump and his administration could get blamed for that.
Well, you know, that's a tough one. I mean, people should not build and certainly not rebuild in areas of states that are prone to flooding, or they should accept paying very, very high payments for their insurance. It just makes sense from a market standpoint and from a logic standpoint, particularly in this era of climate change where we're seeing these storms getting worse and worse and worse. Now, the Trump administration has cast doubt on climate change. It'll be interesting to hear if any of them will suggest that in any way the climate had something to do with this terrible storm, and whether changes need to be made in where people live and how people live because of this disrupted weather. But in the meantime, I think really what we ought to be looking for is just basic competence out of FEMA, out of the federal government. Trump is very lucky that he has John Kelly now in his close office, the former DHS secretary, who really knows how to manage this type of situation. He will ensure, it seems to me, that Trump gets the kind of information that he needs. This FEMA director, Long, is considered quite good. He's been in federal emergency management in the past. They have the advantage of knowing that this is on its way and getting those resources into Texas, into Louisiana to be prepared. Nobody wants to be compared to President Bush and Katrina in 2005. That is a lesson that every elected official, every politician will take with them forever. You just cannot let the federal government and states cannot let the state government fall down in an issue of that level of magnitude, of people losing their homes, losing their lives because of a terrible storm. So let's all hope that they're very well prepared and that President Trump oversees a very smooth reaction to this.
Something that's not so smooth that came out today back in Washington, we're learning that the economic advisor Gary Cohn drafted a letter of resignation and also met privately with President Trump last week. That was in response to the deadly Charlottesville rally by white supremacists and by Donald Trump's response to that. Cohn is Jewish. He told the Financial Times, quote, "As a Jewish American, I will not allow neo-Nazis ranting, 'Jews will not replace us,' to cause this Jew to leave his job." Does it look like he's going to be staying, Jesse?
Well, what it looks like is that he's saying that he plans to stay on and fight for him from the inside. It really put him in a bad position to have to stand there next to President Trump when he did not denounce the white supremacy and said that there were good people on all sides. But what it seems like he was saying this morning is that he's not going to let the people chanting "Jews will not replace us" to turn around and make him lose his job and have somebody replace him. So he plans to speak out from the inside. That's going to be a tough thing to do, especially in the current climate.
And Jesse, I want to stay with you for a minute because remember Democrats, the other party? We just haven't heard. We hear nothing. And we're reading in today's New York Times, there's a new general slogan, hashtag rise and organize, but deep division on how much to focus on debates over Confederate monuments, which falls into the trap of identity politics. We heard Steve Bannon say, bring it. You know, it's such a complicated matter, and it's seen, as many people in the country, as leaving them out of a conversation. So where are Democrats going here?
It seems to be an interesting conversation going on the Democratic side on how much they need to engage. Because right now, they can really sit back and just watch Republicans argue over this issue. Because keep in mind, most of these Confederate statues are in Republican-controlled states. So there's not going to be any movement unless the Republicans want there to be. So Democrats have to figure out where they want to be and whether it's worth it for them to engage, especially considering the demographics of their party. So we're seeing, especially in the deep South states, we're seeing Democrats saying, of course, these statutes need to go. Our constituency is demanding these statutes need to go. But they can't make any moves without the Republicans' party consent. So that's where the actual arguments are going to be, and the resolution is going to have to come from that side as well.
That's Jesse Holland. He covers race, ethnicity, and politics for the Associated Press. Beth Fooey, senior politics editor at NBC News and MSNBC. We do have a big storm heading towards the Texas coast, Harvey, the hurricane. And so that's going to be taking the wind out of a lot of these conversations. We will be paying attention there. But thanks so much for our look at politics. Jesse, Beth, thank you.
Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
This week saw some big losses. Our conversation with comic Jerry Lewis is at hereandnow.org. But we want to take a moment to reflect on the death of comedian and social activist Dick Gregory, who also died at 84. He was born into abject poverty in 1932 in St. Louis, Missouri. He started telling jokes as a kid to keep from being made fun of. After serving in the Army's Entertainment Division, he performed in black clubs in Chicago. And then in 1951, the big break. He was called to replace an act at Hugh Hefner's Playboy Club. He was a hit, even though the crowd was all white Southern executives. As Gregory said, it was the first they'd seen a black comic not bucking his eyes, dancing, and telling mother-in-law jokes. Just talking about what I read in the newspaper. What was that? Well, first of all, a warning. It was, as we're going to hear, about what blacks were called in that day, including the N-word. Roy Wood Jr. is a correspondent for The Daily Show with Trevor Noah. He joins us now from St. Louis Public Radio. Roy, the 50s, before Pryor, before Cosby, before he could even enter many clubs because of segregation, what was Dick Gregory talking about?
He was talking about black comedy at that time being something that was a little more demonstrative and not always intellectually on the same plane as white comedy. So for a black man to dare to have an opinion about things that were going on in the world in the 50s, mind you, that was still very much black man stay in your place, America.
The comedy would be sort of shuck and jive. And then shall we do a couple? Because they stick with you. He was the guy who said, I went into a restaurant and they said, we don't serve colored folk here. And I said, well, that's okay. I don't eat colored folk. I was ordering some chicken and the Ku Klux Klan members who were nearby said, we're going to do to you what you do to that chicken. And he said, oh, really? And picked it up and kissed it. He was talking about what nobody talked about.
To think about that Klan intimidation humor in the 50s.
When people were being lynched.
I call it juggling dynamite. That's what I call it in the professional comedy world, where you can take something that could really tick off a lot of people and still manage to stick the landing without the dynamite going off in your hand. And Dick Gregory was a master of that.
Yeah. Segregation is not all bad, he said. Have you ever heard of a collision where the people in the back of the bus got hurt? Let's listen to some of his earlier performance talking about black power.
White folks in this country dirtied up the word black. Not us. White folks in America corrupted power. Not us. And one day we come free. One day we come through with two innocent words, black power, and everybody go crazy. But had we said brown strength, oh, everybody would have accepted that. Hell, we wouldn't be able to walk down the street without white folks greeting us. Brown strength, my brother, brown strength.
You could take the premise of a lot of Dick Gregory jokes, and it would feel and read like something of an activist. But it's the back half of those bits where he turns from the premise into the punchline where he gets you to laugh. But the beginning of that joke is a full-blown indictment of white people and the vilification of the word black. There's no corners cut in that premise. But yet I believe that to be a joke everybody could laugh at.
Again, if you put it in context, that word black was frightening to people. It hadn't been used before. It had been colored or Negro. That word black was a lightning rod that he seized. And I'm thinking, too, when he went on Jack Parr's show, the first Tonight Show, he said, I want to sit on the couch. And he became the first black to do that, which you can't, you know, now that you think of the stream, Kevin Hart, Dave Chappelle, you, that's amazing that there was a time when there was a first. What did he mean for you as a comic?
Granted, I only saw him perform two or three times in my career, but every time I left feeling the need to become a better person, which to me is larger than comedy. You know, it's one thing to see one of the greats that are doing it today and go, man, I got to write better jokes. I got to work on my stage presence. I got to work on my delivery. But I would see Dick Gregory and instantly I felt like I wasn't doing enough as a person. I used to joke back in the day that you'd see a Dick Gregory show and leave and like try and start four charities. Like you would just call up your accountant. Listen, I got to do something. I did 501(c), 501(4)c, 501(5)c. Yeah. I need to do all the 50Cs.
Because he was so involved in so many causes, African-American health. He was overweight at one point, cigarette smoker, became a vegetarian, and encouraged others to reject fried foods, fat foods.
Yes.
He went on hunger strikes to bring awareness to the Vietnam War, women's rights, apartheid in South Africa, American Indian rights. I mean, he was so busy being good.
And somewhere in the midst of all of that, still had time to go swing by a comedy club and entertain 200 or 300 people. You know, I feel like the legacy he's left behind, I hope, is enough to inspire that next wave of black comedians to be as bold and to be as daring, because you're sometimes staring in the face of doing what will help your people versus what will help your career. And those two things don't always align themselves, but they definitely didn't align themselves for Dick Gregory, you know, between the 50s, 60s, and 70s. Because I just have to put this into context. To demand the couch on a show, like there's no comic today in the much more calmer racial and entertainment climate that we have now versus the 50s who would make that career dice roll. I know a lot of shows make you submit your jokes. Forget asking for the couch. We want to see what jokes you're going to tell. Type them out and send them to us so that we can look through them. That just shows you how bold he was and how unique of a spirit he was.
He was jailed in Birmingham, Alabama in 1963. He wrote, "It was the first really good beating I've ever had in my life." Ha, ha, ha. You know, sort of a bitter comedy there. And then there's the autobiography. It was titled Nigger, an Autobiography, 1964. What was his goal with that?
I think it was to shock people. To me, just the title alone is a classic mirror to society. Since you're going to call me this word, then this is who I am. So come figure out who I am and know about my life.
Yeah. That's what a comic is, a mirror to society.
Oh, 100%. I feel like to some degree, stand-up comedy is one of the purest forms of journalism. We see the same things you see, and then we report on it with a little bit more of a slant.
Of an edge.
Yes.
Well, so he's mirroring back that word, also claiming it, as he wrote in the foreword to his deceased mother, "Wherever you are, if you ever hear the word nigger again, remember they're advertising my book." And here he is on Late Night with David Letterman performing in 1984.
One thing about America, we are able to talk about ethnic slurs and flush it out. You know, what happens when you're in a country where they talk a foreign language and you don't know what they said about you? See, I had that happen to me in Russia. My wife and I were walking down the street, and Lillian just smiling, waving at this Russian. So I said, "What's wrong with you?" She said, "He just said hello. You don't know what he said." He said, "Oh, he might have called you a nigger." She said, "Well, what must I do next time?" I said, "Do what I do. Just smile, say same to you and your mama."
So, you know, and that was televised, and we're reminded that, as you said, sometimes your jokes today are screened, and you might try to slip an immigration joke past bookers, and you can't?
Well, I did successfully with Letterman, but you will tend to find that a lot of the edgier humor that pushes the envelope, you will not find in the late night 4.5-minute format on television these days. And a lot of that has to do with the networks and producers wanting a particular type of image or not wanting to stir the pot, and we're definitely in much more of a political backlash culture now than ever existed where comedy is concerned. So it still happens, but I believe it happens more in the longer form, half-hour specials that you more often see on, you know, your Comedy Centrals and your Netflix and your Showtimes and HBOs.
Roy, as we go out, do you have a Dick Gregory moment?
To me, the one that just always has stuck with me is the one real conversation I had with Mr. Gregory, and I just asked him, why does he still travel? He was knocking on 80. And you have to understand, this dude was traveling the same as a regular road comic. I don't know his full schedule, but I know Dick Gregory was always out of town. Mm-hmm. So we're talking 200 days a year on average, you know, anywhere mm-hmm. from 15 to 20 days a month. This dude was out there. And I couldn't figure it out. And I know what it takes to maintain a travel schedule that's grueling and wears your body down. And he just said, son, the fight for freedom is out there. It ain't at my house.
Roy Wood Jr., correspondent for The Daily Show with Trevor Noah, and his Comedy Central special, Father Figure, released this year. Roy, thank you.
Thank you.
Now, more Dick Gregory. He, his wife, and their 11 kids had just bought a house in a white neighborhood.
So we got about 11 inches of snow in Chicago, and I grabbed my shovel, went out, started cleaning the snow off my new front, and my neighbors pulled up. She jumped out the car and rushed up to me. She said, hey, boy! She said, you're really doing a wonderful job on these people's front. If you only knew. She said, yep, I've been living next door here for the last 50 years, and I've never seen this place looking this good in the wintertime. What do you get for doing that? I said, oh, I get to sleep with that woman inside.
It's here now.
People living along the Texas coast are evacuating their homes today as Hurricane Harvey gains muscle in the Gulf of Mexico. Forecasters say Harvey will make landfall late tonight or early tomorrow near Corpus Christi as a Category 3 storm. Wind speeds may surpass 110 miles an hour, and officials are warning the powerful surges coupled with heavy rain could lead to catastrophic flooding. Texas Governor Greg Abbott has declared a state of emergency in 30 counties. But yesterday, at a news conference, Corpus Christi Mayor Joe McComb said he would not force people to evacuate.
I think people are smart enough to make their decisions, and they don't need the government telling them what to do. But at some point in the storm, let me reiterate, there will come a time that rescue operations will cease, and everybody has to go in and protect their own lives.
Let's bring in Claire McInerney, who's a reporter with Here and Now contributor KUT. She has been reporting from Victoria, Texas, about 30 miles inland from the Gulf and about 100 miles northeast of Corpus Christi. We heard Mayor McComb there, Claire, telling people they should make up their own minds. But Victoria, where you were today, is under a mandatory evacuation. What are the conditions like there, and are people leaving?
Yeah, so right now the weather hasn't really started. It's very overcast and it's sprinkling and the winds have started a little bit, but everyone's being very precautionary. And yes, in Victoria, people were listening to the mandatory evacuation and leaving. When I was driving around the town, the Target, the Walmart, everything was empty. People weren't trying to hunker down and stay there. They were on the roads. And I was trying to check into a hotel, and all of the hotels were also following the evacuation and were having people check out and telling them to leave town. So it really is serious, and people are taking it seriously not to stay.
So people are able to go elsewhere, to other hotels farther away?
Yeah, so I ended up coming 30 miles north to another town, and it's not supposed to be as bad here farther away from the coast. So, but a lot of people were talking about going to some of the bigger cities that are getting ready to welcome evacuees.
What does the evacuation itself look like? I mean, how crowded are the streets? Can people actually get anywhere?
Yeah, so I actually had very little trouble. I think people have been paying attention throughout the week. But I did see a lot of RVs, things like that, people trying to get a lot of stuff out of town. But it's not crowded. I was able to get around easily. Gas stations are equipped. The town I ended up in right now, Yoakum, I heard that the grocery stores still have water and bread. So I think being in the area where hurricanes happen, a lot of people were trying to be very precautionary and prepared.
Forecasters say, and this is one of the daunting things, the storm is expected to stall over land and leaving up to 3 feet of rain in some areas. How well prepared do cities and towns along the coastline especially seem to be for that much water?
unfortunately, with flooding, geography plays a huge role. So low areas will have flood issues for days and maybe even weeks after the storm hits, and there's nothing you can really do in terms of preparing. A lot of people keep saying, I'm just waiting to see how bad it actually is, to see if it, you know, pivots or, you know, dissipates as it comes onto land. You know, down here by the coast, flooding is surely going to be an issue. A lot of people talk about certain highways that, you know, are kind of low, so those will have trouble getting clear. But even in cities farther away, like Austin, which is where I came from, the heavy rainfall is expected to cause some road issues in lower areas.
All right. Thank you very much, Claire McInerney, reporter at KUT in Texas. As residents prepare there for Harvey's landfall, either late tonight or early tomorrow morning, Claire, be safe. Good luck and thank you.
Thank you, Lisa.
Authorities in Thailand are searching for the country's former prime minister after she failed to show up for today's verdict in her corruption trial. Yingluck Shinawatra was accused of negligence in overseeing a program to give subsidies to rice farmers, a program that rocked the Thai economy. She said she was innocent and that the charges were politically motivated. Yingluck was Thailand's first female prime minister when her party swept elections 6 years ago. Her trial is the latest chapter in a decade-long struggle by the nation's elite minority to crush the powerful political machine that was founded by Yingluck's brother. Her brother, Thaksin Shinawatra, was toppled in a coup 11 years ago. He has lived in Dubai since he fled his own corruption conviction. He says that was politically motivated. The military junta that seized control of Thailand in 2014 has suppressed dissent and banned political gatherings of more than five people. The long-awaited decision in the case of Yingluck Shinawatra has rekindled tension in the divided nation, but the military remains firmly in charge. The BBC's Jonathan Head is in Bangkok, and Jonathan set the scene for us at the courthouse today.
Well, we've seen court appearances by Yingluck Shinawatra before. She's a very telegenic, very popular, very attractive woman. She gets huge numbers of supporters coming in, even though we're under military rule and politics aren't allowed. At these occasions, you see that the mass support for her is still there. And to be honest, everybody thought the same thing would be happening this time. Her brother Thaksin fled into exile 9 years ago when he also faced a verdict at the Supreme Court, but she'd refused to consider it. And it seemed that she was defiant, that she wanted to be a sort of symbol of resistance to the military. And there were lots of people out there, very typically from the north and northeast of Thailand. These are poorer areas of the country. A lot of poor farmers and people from the lower sections of society who really see the Shinawatra family and their party as a party that enacted policies that lifted the living standards of those at the bottom. And they're very, very loyal. They come clutching red roses, wearing clothes they fashioned that often have her image on them. And they're wearing gloves, white gloves with the word love printed on it. A very easygoing scene, even though the government had worried a bit about disorder. Usually they're pretty jolly, these crowds. And they waited, and she simply didn't show up, and we had no idea what the problem was. Her lawyers then appeared. They said that she was feeling ill. She was suffering from vertigo. The court hadn't believed that because they issued an arrest warrant immediately, and within an hour or two, sources close to her party said that, in fact, she decided to leave the country. So it was a bit of a shock.
One of the reasons it's thought that she has left the country, if indeed she has, is that she was expected to be found guilty and receive a pretty harsh sentence. What would it be?
Well, she could have faced up to 10 years in prison for a charge. It's an odd charge. It's sort of like negligence. She wasn't charged with corruption, but she was charged with failing to prevent it. In a very generous rice subsidy scheme, when she'd been in office, it was very popular with farmers, where the government bought the entire rice crop, and this is a very big rice-producing country, for a very generous price. And it certainly, I mean, anecdotally, I know it was ridden with corruption. It was very inefficient. There was lots wrong with it. But she argued she'd imposed this policy in good faith, that she had ordered people to investigate corruption and that as a politician, not actually carrying out the scheme day to day, she couldn't be held responsible for it. But certainly, I think that look in Thailand, in a situation like this, this is a special court in the Supreme Court that tries political office holders. Everyone knows there's a political dimension to the trial, even though the courts are officially independent. And that Yingluck Shinawat is the most high-profile political defendant in the country, that her family have dominated electoral politics in the past, and that the military want them weakened, they want them out of politics. That was the background, and it's assumed that there were some kind of negotiations or discussions between her, possibly her exiled brother Thaksin, and the military authorities about what she'd get. There was lots of speculation here in Thailand, and we knew that if the military felt they should punish her, there was a risk if they put her in prison, there'd be an angry backlash because she's very popular. If they let her off, other people would say you're letting off people who've carried out corruption. They were in a dilemma. And we don't know what happened with those negotiations. But at some point in the last 48 hours, something didn't work out. And she, after all these months, even two or three years of defiance and saying she'd stay, clearly felt that she couldn't. And we don't know the reasons yet. She hasn't appeared or spoken. But certainly, we'd expected some kind of compromise and it didn't happen. And that's probably because in the end, the authorities had decided probably to give her a very severe sentence.
So we're talking again about the former prime minister who was ousted in a coup 3 years ago by the military. The military promised that it would be in charge as it took over for only a short period. But again, years have passed since then. What is the current state of life in Thailand for people there under military rule?
Well, it's a military government. Quite a lot of political activity is banned and people do get locked up. And there are some quite severe political charges that are imposed on a few dissidents. Broadly, life hasn't changed a lot. The economy is not doing as well as it did. And I think there is a hunger to get back to some kind of normal democratic rule, which tends to make the economy go better. And the military understands that. They keep promising to do it. They've delayed their roadmap for getting back to democracy, but we're pretty certain they do want an exit strategy. Their worry is they've never felt comfortable with Yingluck Shinawat's family because its party has always dominated politics. It's always been the biggest party in the last 20 years, and they worry it could have that dominance again. And when they launched their coup 3 years ago, A scarcely hidden objective of the military was to weaken the Shinawat clan. And it was always assumed that the trial of Yingluck Shinawat, even though there were a lot of abuses in the Rice scheme, was essentially to try to damage her because she was such a vote winner for the party. Today, we've seen a conclusion of that process. We thought there'd be a verdict. We thought she might go to prison. She might not. In the end, she's fled. What she can do from overseas, we don't know. But her party still remains there as potentially the largest party. It's likely to be the largest party when elections come back. And many parts of the country still support her strongly. So all the divisions in Thai politics that preceded the military coup, they're really still there. They're kept under wraps. The military doesn't allow people to demonstrate or to show their feelings too much. But there's no real sign yet that they've solved the underlying problems, that they will not emerge again once the military dares to let the country go back to some kind of electoral politics.
Jonathan, just one final question. In the larger picture, I mean, you've covered this region for so long. What is this unrest doing to the state of affairs between the United States and Thailand? I mean, this is a very important area for the U.S.
Thailand is the U.S.'s oldest ally in this region, and we saw relations deteriorate after the last military coup. The U.S. had been quite supportive of Yingluck Shinawat's government. It saw it as democratic. It had a democratic mandate. There are automatic sanctions that come into play whenever there's any suspension of democratic government. Behind the scenes, the relationship between the militaries of the two countries is very good still. Thailand's military has always looked to the U.S. as a supporting partner. But we've seen the government, run by generals, shifting rather more to China because they didn't like the criticism of human rights. After 3 years, particularly under the Trump administration, which has a different set of values, we are seeing the US and Thailand move back together. And I think the situation in North Korea is changing US priorities here. There's been some real tension with its traditional allies, the Philippines and Thailand. Under the Trump administration, we're seeing a pragmatic realignment with these countries, an attempt to rebuild bridges, to build up as much support as possible. But I have to say the underlying reality is that U.S. influence, despite President Obama's attempt to pivot to this region, has been in relative decline. The rise of China is a fact of life. The insolubility of the North Korean crisis and the North Korean problem is a fact of life. And all the countries in this region recognize that the U.S. is still an important presence, but simply can't be as decisive an influence as it once was.
The BBC's Jonathan Head in Bangkok, Thailand. Nice to speak with you. Thank you.
Good to talk to you, Lisa.
Across the country, there are efforts underway to lure young people away from gangs. One program in Boston has taken a unique approach, paying former gang members to go back to school and then on to college. Fred Tice from WBUR explains how it works.
Mark Culleton has some big ambitions. He'd like to end gang-related violence, and he's starting in the Boston neighborhood of Dorchester. Culleton's target, the most disruptive people in inner-city neighborhoods, gang members.
Engaging them and moving them from the corner to college. So really this idea that what makes a quote-unquote bad neighborhood is really a small group of highly disengaged, highly disruptive young people, usually involved in gangs, but that want to do something positive.
Culleton founded an organization called College Bound Dorchester. It hires mentors who have experiences similar to kids in gangs to help former gang members get their GEDs and then into community colleges.
Kids rise to the expectations you set for them. So we're the only program in the country focused on gang-involved youth that has college as a baseline expectation.
College Bound Dorchester pays ex-gang members to go to college. 36 students get $400 a week now. 20 are in community college. Another 10 are expected to join them next month. Matt Jackson is one of those being paid to go to college. He decided to get out of gang life after his daughter's mother was killed.
Gang shooting. Basically, she was an innocent bystander. And, you know, the only thing I was trying to figure out was, like, how could I provide for my daughter?
Jackson realized he could not go back to jail. The stipend enables him to focus on his studies without worrying about supporting himself and his daughter. He's now finished his first semester at Bunker Hill Community College in Boston. He's 34. He grew up in the projects of Boston's South End until he went to prison at 17.
Growing up, basically in my neighborhood, what we did was sold drugs. We didn't look at it as a game, you know, because we all, you know, were neighbors. Like, you know, we're all kids. We played on the same basketball teams, football teams, went to the same school. Those are my friends, like, for real, like, people I've really known since first, second, third grade. Drugs were known to us, like, a lot of our parents used or sold them.
College Bound Dorchester showed him another way.
Like, as long as people could, like, be reached and see that there's something else, I feel like, man, you know, especially quote-unquote gang members won't, you know, partake in the things that they do.
On a drive with Mark Culleton, College Bound Dorchester program coordinator Ismail Abdul-Rashid rattles off the geography of Boston's gangs as we pass through their territories.
7 Ave, 700, Buckshot, Wainwright.
He will name dozens of groups over the course of 2 evenings. He says most have several members whom College Bound Dorchester has served over the last 18 months. Culleton explains that it's at the corners that the violence is concentrated.
There's gaps and nothing really happening, and then you'll get to a certain area and there's like 6, 7, 8 small crews all within, you know, 5 or 6 blocks. So it makes for a pretty volatile-like situation.
We come up on one such intersection when Abdul-Rashid notices that one of his students has not shown up in a while.
Mike, what's up with you, man? Come on, come on, man. What's up with you? Take my number, man.
All right.
Come on, man. When you coming back, man?
As soon as I can get up in there. Monday. All right, because I ain't going to lie. I've really been...
Monday. All right, be good now. Yeah. See, that's the work. I mean, we always, you know, bump into our students.
Now he's recently been released, so now we have to re-engage him and get him reconnected, you know. Very bright young man. Has everything, you know, that he needs academically to be able to transition and be successful on a college campus. It's just the attitudinal stuff, you know, the soft skills that we have to actively engage them around, you know, the efficacy and the self-discipline.
College Bound Dorchester is working with Northeastern University and MIT's J-PAL Poverty Action Lab to evaluate how effective the program is. Ben Struhl, who manages the Poverty Action Lab's crime and criminal justice programs, is optimistic.
We have a lot of exciting research that shows it is possible to make a difference in the lives of older youth and even adults who might be at risk of committing crime and violence.
Cognitive behavior therapy has proved to be effective in reducing gang violence in Chicago, and summer jobs have proved to be effective at reducing violent crime beyond the summer in Chicago and New York. On another night driving the streets of Dorchester, Ismail Abdulrashid says the same yearning that gets these young people into gangs can be used to save them from gangs.
You know, they want to belong to something, a sense of belonging.
If this intervention works here in Boston, Mark Culleton hopes his college-bound program can be a model for other cities.
This is a group that has the potential to end generational urban poverty in America in a very real way.
For Here and Now, I'm Fred Tice.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Lisa Mullins in for Jeremy Hobson. He'll be back Monday. This is Here and Now.